Hi everyone, my name's Nathan Green and this is Sample Space, the podcast from the Department of Statistical Science here at UCL. I'm very pleased to be speaking with Mine Doju about something a little bit different today. So we're going to be talking about teaching and education in the context of statistics and her experiences and some things that I know absolutely nothing about, so I'm really looking forward to it. So hi, Mine. Before we crack on with that, would you like to give an introduction, a bit of your own background, please?
So I just joined the department in July, actually. I'm pretty new in the department and in the UK. I moved here from California. I was an assistant professor of teaching in the Department of Statistics at the University of California, Irvine. I was also the vice chair of undergraduate studies there.
Okay, so how long have you been in the department?
Since July, so we're recording this at the end of September. Uh-huh. So it's actually, today is my second month anniversary in London.
Okay, well, and happy anniversary. So how's it going?
So far, so good, I must say. I really like the teaching community in the department. So this is very unusual for me because back in California, I was the only professor focused on teaching. And here we have a very big group of teaching lecturers and professors. So this is something very new and very exciting for me.
So what have you been working on before you came to UCL?
So I think most recently, my biggest time was spent on Bayesian education. So I was teaching a Bayesian course for undergraduates in the United States. Actually, a Bayesian course for undergraduates is not quite common, as common in the US. I know we are in a very Bayesian department. Actually, we worked recently on an education research looking at universities in the US and how many of them offer Bayesian courses and so on. So it's not as common as one would think. So I was teaching a Bayesian course, and from that course, we started writing a textbook with my collaborators at different institutions, Alicia Johnson and Miles Ott. So it's the Bayes Rules book. So a good portion of my time was spent on writing that book and preparing teaching materials for a Bayesian course for undergraduate audience.
How do they do that now? Because I remember there was a conflict between whether you should bring in the Bayesian stuff at the beginning and sort of mix it with the frequentist, or whether how it was taught to me like 20 odd years ago, it's the frequentist stuff. And then if you're interested later on, you might do some Bayesian stuff. So what's like your take on that?
I teach the same way. Like I used to teach senior fourth year students in the United States, and they used to get their frequentist training, and some Bayesian concepts would show up in their training as well. But like their first training is really like full training in Bayesian statistics would be in their last year of their degree, which is the fourth year. And to be honest, even I know that there's a big debate, should we teach Bayesian or not? Like depends on who you ask. But one thing I've noticed through teaching Bayesian statistics is actually it helps students understand frequentist statistics as well. So for instance, at the beginning of my course, and our textbooks also, like we covered the foundations and so on and simulation approximating the posterior. But once we get using the posterior and making inferences like hypothesis testing and so on, I know very well, like in every time I teach hypothesis testing from a Bayesian perspective, students actually start thinking about hypothesis testing from frequentist perspective as well. Like we teach p-values over and over, and p-values are very hard to internalize what they mean, what they represent. But once they actually see hypothesis testing from a Bayesian perspective and think about given data concept versus given null hypothesis truth, that's when they actually understand what they have been doing in their frequentist classes all along. It makes a little bit much more sense once they see the Bayesian perspective because they have something to compare it with.
That's really interesting. So it doesn't kind of confuse them to have these two different ways of thinking about it.
I don't think so.
And what's kind of, is there a preference? Because like you said, our department is very Bayesian, so we're all very biased. But it just seems a lot more of a natural way to do things, especially in terms of the interpretations of things, you know, like credible intervals and what have you. So what do you find from how the students what's the feedback from the students?
So when I teach the course, and in general, like I never put pressure on students. Like I'm not trying to raise next generation Bayesians, but I do want students to be literate in Bayesian statistics, and they should be able to choose frequentist or Bayesian methods depending on their research questions and where they end up in life. So the goal is not necessarily to make them Bayesians, but I must confess that they do enjoy course a lot. And they do end up saying things like, oh, frequentist statistics was lying to us all this time with hypothesis testing. So I do get comments like that, and they do have Bayesian tendencies towards the end. But I also have students, for instance, who like they take 10 weeks of course and they still oppose the idea of building a prior year model. So I have all sorts of ideas, and they're all welcome in the classroom, to be honest, because they all exist in the statistics community as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair, actually. Whichever side of the argument you're on, you're always going to meet both the approaches. That's definitely true. And I've noticed that sort of more of a pragmatism more recently. You know, it's not like everything's Bayesian, everything's frequentist. People just don't care anymore in the same way. People aren't getting angry at conferences like they used to.
Yeah, that is true. And also, like, from an education perspective, I would rather have my students be informed and pick up fights if they're going to pick up fights than not know about the topic and pick up fights. So we want we want them to be educated about the topic.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so that's like what you're teaching. How are you teaching it? Do you sort of teach the intuition behind the method, and then you sort of introduce the sort of the equations, and it's sort of, do you do it that way, or do you sort of just show them the equations up front and then pull it apart?
No, we actually leave math until the end, so the teaching in the course is very much computer assisted, especially visualizations. Visualizations really help students see what's happening to posterior, basically. How is prior influencing the posterior? How is likelihood is influencing the posterior? Like, if you think about driving, let's say, the beta binomial model, when they look at even the beta PDF, beta PDF, we actually, like, students just look at it as Greek letters, right? Mm. Whereas if you show a couple of beta PDFs, they can actually see how the parameters are influencing the distribution. So visualizations really help them internalize that. And also visualizations help them try different scenarios, like what happens when the prior is flat, what happens if it's a informative prior, highly informative prior, or what happens when we have more data. So the MLE might be similar, but if the data is more, if you collect more data, what happens to the posterior? So they actually see the influence of more evidence collection and how that influences our conclusions. So I really, for that reason, actually, we support the book with an R package that has different sets of functions, but a core set of functions is actually making these visualizations easy.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It's the same material in the book, Bayes rule book, as it is in that you do in the lectures, is it? And then that's also all linked with the package.
That is correct. Because we, my co-authors and same, they were also teaching similar courses in their institutions. So we wrote the books based on our course notes and reiterated, changed things in our courses, in the book and so on. So it was a continuous project, intertwined the book and the courses.
Yeah, nice. And it's an online book, right? So you can, it's like a live document.
That is absolutely true. It's at bayesrulesbook.com. And that was actually when we first started writing the book, before even reaching out to publishers for proposals. That was our first criteria. We will make this book accessible online. And thankfully, our publisher, CRC, was fine with that, and we make it open accessible.
Great. Okay. Well, I think I need to read it. okay, so can you explain to me what accessibility is in education, please?
Absolutely. So we just talked about having an open access book, for instance. So the book is actually read by hundreds of users every day. Maybe I'm not sure how much is read, but at least the website is visited by hundreds of users every day. sometimes thousands of users, depending on some social media posts, somebody posts. And if you think about it, these users come from different parts of the world. And I'm not sure if you just had a physical book, this would have made it to everywhere in the world, to be honest. So part of accessibility is actually lowering down costs, which is a big barrier in education because textbooks cost a lot. So by making open access resources, not just books, but other teaching materials as well, like our slides, our hand notes, our worksheets, these can also be open access as well. So I try to do as much as possible on that end from my own courses. But as we were writing Bayes Rules book, we also learned a little bit about accessibility from different perspective, which is visual access. Like for colorblind people, making sure that the plots are accessible because we use different color for prior likelihood and posterior, and they should be visible to someone with colorblindness. And also something exciting happened during this book. We were learning about how to make it accessible for people with visual impairments or blind people. We wanted to provide descriptions of figures so that people who use screen readers can actually read the plots and make sense of the plots. And we wrote the book using the R package Bookdown, but the book Bookdown actually did not support, these are called alternate texts for figures. Bookdown back then, R Markdown or Knit R packages did not support alternate texts back then. And we requested it from the team who develops R Markdown, and they actually started using this, developing this. So now R Markdown actually has alternate text available, and the new generation R Markdown, which is Quarto, also supports alternate text. So we were able to write our book with alternate text for figures, which was exciting for us.
Yeah, that sounds great. How does that practically work? Do you write a description and then do you record an audio which is attached to the book, or how does that work?
Good question. So alternate text is actually available in many software. This is not something only statisticians should consider, like even if you do PowerPoint presentations, even if you post on Twitter. But the way it works is like on websites. So you're maybe thinking about a print book, but I should clarify, I'm talking about the online book. Somebody who reads a screen reader, the screen reader can actually read every text on there. But when it comes to a plot, if there is no alternate text attached to a plot, the screen reader would just read it as plot or plot.jpg or something. So we have to, on the back end, provide some description for the plot. And so it's not an audio file, it's actually a written part of the document. So for those who use R Markdown, it's actually a fig.alt chunk option, but it's actually an HTML. In HTML, there's an image alternate text, and this is supported in many, many platforms.
I suppose I could use that in journal papers, could use that, and you know, like it's applicable to everything.
So you would think that would be the case, Nathan. Mm. Once I wrote a manuscript, in fact, part of that, actually, it wasn't a manuscript. It was more like a professional organization's magazine piece. And I was talking about alternate text in my writing. And unfortunately, they published their magazine in PDF, and PDF is one of the least accessible formats, whereas HTML is much more accessible. And I insisted that they publish it in HTML. And this publication has been around at least 50 years. And I think, I'm afraid, mine was the first HTML publication that they did. And that was only because I insisted that they put alternate text. Actually, getting journals to publish your alternate text is a very deep battle
to fight.
So I hope that professional organizations and journals take this. I think one good organization that does this well is, or better, should I say, not best, but ACM, American Computing Machinery Group, does have a good accessibility group that do have guidelines for journals and conferences to take on accessibility.
So if I get a paper published, I should always mention that we should sort of collectively put pressure on. And what happens to equations?
So for equations, usually using math jacks usually helps with screen readers, but I think so I'm not 100% sure about this. Maybe I shouldn't be quoted, but it is very difficult because it's audio after all, and getting subscripts, superscripts all where it should be is a hard task to get in audio. That definitely becomes challenging, yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's a bit more of a work in progress.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had a win with package down or book down, sorry. So if anyone wants to do it in book down now, they can.
They can. And our markdown supported packages or Quarto, like book down, block down, our markdown, Quarto, all of these make it possible to write alternate texts.
Okay, cool. I'm going to try that as well.
So this also made me consider like why it took me many years coming out of PhD to figure all these things out, even though I always have visual components in my work. And so I started questioning things like our markdown, like why did it take so many years to support this? And I think one of the reasons is because in statistics programs, we don't actually learn about accessibility. Accessibility, we can think about, like, accessibility is relevant to any field, really, but also there's accessibility specifically for statistics and data science, like how do we verbalize plots, for instance, and so on. So this made me question, and there's a very good group of industry and education partners called Teach Access. So they try to close this gap. So they try to help instructors teach accessibility to their students. They give grants for this. And I was lucky enough to get a grant from them. And I started actually teaching my own students accessibility as part of their data science courses. Of course, I have a lot to do on this end. I cannot say that it's in great shape right now, but I think we have to consider our curricular design, because if we don't teach it, we're not going to know. Maybe by chance, we might hear it on a podcast or something.
Exactly. I mean, I've never heard of it. You know, I'm old. So is there like a, not quite a template, but is there like a format that you can use to describe a certain type of plot, for example? You know, is there a certain language lexicon that you'd use for that? Has it been standardized?
Good question. So there are two resources I can recommend. One is, so there is an automatic way to do this. One of them is Braille R package in R. And this would actually is aimed for doing writing automated figure out text, and people with visual impairments also use this. But the thing is, it only supports a few plots like histograms, bar plots, and so on. But if you think about scatter plots, that they're very hard to describe because there is some trend that we are trying to capture. Same with trace plots in Bayesian statistics, for instance. After all, these are automated. What it's trying to do is like, it's trying to read the height of the bar. It's trying to read what's on the x-axis, y-axis, and so on. But trace plots, you're not going to read every point on a trace plot, right? Automatically. So they become harder to manage. But there are people working in this area. And they're also like people from computer science part who are trying to build software who can automate this process and so on. But in terms of writing from like manual perspective, there are some guidelines too. One of them is by Amy Sizzle. If you actually type to Google, I bet it will show up like writing alternate text for data plots. Hers would be the first one to pop up. It's a Medium post. And she does talk about like what to include. Some of these, like most important part is using units, x-axis, y-axis, what's the plot, like it's a histogram, scatter plot, but most importantly, what is it telling, what the message in that plot is. And usually a rule of thumb for accessibility, if you include visualization, if you can include your data in raw format somewhere, either in a GitHub report, something is better because a visually impaired user can interact with your data if they want to find out more about it and the original data source. A very good website for this also, even though I'm I always use R for my work and my teaching, but SAS is actually pretty good with accessibility, and their accessibility website has very good examples on interacting with data and plots.
Great. Okay, well, I'll make sure to include those in the in the text that goes along with this podcast, so people can check all that out. Including the raw data is one way of helping reproducibility, right? So the last point I have here is reproducible teaching. So what do you mean by that? That's the other thing that sounds sort of modern and I've been left behind with.
So in statistics education, if I think about software, we tend to focus on two things. One is statistical software we use for teaching statistics, and the other one is for doing statistics. And when we say teaching, what I mean is what the students are learning as students. So this used to be like Minitab, let's say, and now it's maybe we're teaching R. But at the same time, we wrote a preprints and we're arguing that there's a third dimension, and that's what the instructor uses themselves for teaching. So for instance, I could be teaching Minitab, let's say, I wouldn't be, but I could be using R Markdown to prepare my slides. So there's a third dimension that gets into the picture. And we always, I think, argue for reproducible research, about doing research. So we want to try to take this from teaching perspective. And this is very important because many students, we try to teach them reproducibility, but they don't necessarily, not every student gets to interact with us from a research perspective. I know that here they do have research projects, but at least in the United States, it's not as common for every student to do a research project. So reproducible teaching in the classroom actually gives students to see their professor or lecturer actually using these tools. So for instance, when I teach, I use GitHub for my course pages. I use R Markdown, and I teach R Markdown. So a student who actually sees me using R Markdown and they have access to my slides, it's open source, open access. So they can, if they see something that I have done in my slides that I'm not necessarily teaching them how to do, they actually go to source code and learn it if they want to. And so basically I'm teaching them the tool, but I'm also using the tool to teach them. And everything we talk about reproducible research, like having version control, having access to data, having literate programming in research, holds true for teaching as well.
I think that's excellent. I mean, everyone I work with, I always say, let's work through GitHub. And more often than not, they don't have an account. They've never used it before. Yeah. So if you're teaching students to be comfortable with using those, that's only a good thing. Yeah. What about like GitHub pages and things? Do you use those features?
Yes, I do use it myself, because my course websites are hosted on GitHub pages. Some of them actually have their own domain names and so on. But for your classroom use, unfortunately, for private repos, it's not, because for my courses, I have a GitHub organization for each course, and private repos are not possible. And student work has to be kept private. So that I had hard time getting work around that. In the last time I was teaching this course,
I remember seeing Jenny Bryan, our studio. I remember seeing some of her stuff which she uses for teaching R, and I was really impressed by how it was like integrating. There was like peer project marking and things, and assigning into groups, and it was all done via GitHub.
Actually, we also have our package that I co-developed with two PhD students back in UC Irvine. And basically, because also like grading, like getting these out of GitHub, and also like opening each, we do a lot of project work, opening these one by one. So we have this package, Grade Tools, that we can actually open a student's project, grade them there. We create the rubric, grade each project, automatically save that and move on to the next project. So we do have, like, even though it seems overwhelming to teach GitHub, there are many resources out there that actually makes the process much easier.
I've got quite a long list of things to do after this call. That's a good sign, I think. Okay, so that's really all I wanted to talk to you about today. Like I said, it's been absolutely fascinating. And I'll probably want to talk to you some more in the future, if that's okay.
I would love to.
Yeah, fantastic. So everyone, go and read the Bayes Rule Book. and not necessarily to be a Bayesian statistician. I'd like to finish by thanking you for talking to us today, and hopefully I will see you soon around the department.
Thank you for having me.
UCL Minds brings together the knowledge, insights and ideas of our community through a wide range of events and activities that are open to everyone.